On my notes and wax on my bed until I just recently washed it, because I have one of these little scented candles, which I discovered is like kind of nice because it gets stuffy up there.
Yeah, it's burning right now over the TV.
Fantastic. I just discovered that thought because it really gets awful up there, and so the candles help a little. Anyway, for a while there, I was able to, and you'll get a kick out of this because you're beginning to understand what a complete weirdo I am. I was able to, when I was ready to put them out, I was able to stand over it and slap my hands together like Superman, and it would just poof. It'd be out. This one was being a little resistant because it had burned down so much. Uh-huh. So I'm giving it a couple good shots and a couple good shots. Then finally I get like too close to it and I hit it. It looks like it goes out at first, but then it just flings the candle with all the wet wax all over the place. So some gets on the bed and some gets on my notes. And I was like, guess I'm not like Superman anymore.
The most ridiculous thing about this story is that I'm gonna imagine do it again, you too. Alone in your bedroom clapping your hands together as fast as you can to put out a candle, and that's just really pathetic, I think.
Oh, sure. That's why I'm telling it, right? Because it's pathetic. Okay, we usually start with what we watched, right?
Sure.
Okay, I can start. I've got some notes here about Sunset Boulevard, though that might lead us into a really long conversation, but either way, that's fine. First thing I wrote in notes, it's got Jack Webb in it. He was in it really quick, and I wrote nice because I like Jack Webb. The interesting narrative structure is that it's got a posthumous narration, and there's this will lead into another film I saw recently that's a classic that I just recently got around to seeing that I had misconceptions about. I always thought that you didn't see that it was him. You just saw a body, and then you heard the narration, and so there was a little bit of mystery left, but no, they just completely reveal that it's him. It's like, that's me floating in the water right there. So that it's like it takes everything out of it. It sort of makes it anticlimactic in some sense, but maybe that's not important. I noted how gruesome it was that he was floating in the pool. Like, that was pretty weird. It was really progressive in the sense that, not progressive is the wrong term, but it was pretty cutting edge in the sense that it was a meta. It had a whole meta element about being about a movie about movies in a way. Mm-hmm. He's a screenwriter and all that, so it's about the movie business. I noted that it was like The Player, if you've seen that Robert Altman film.
Yes, one of my favorites.
Yeah. It's a good one. So you also like this one, too. A dead monkey with an exclamation point. That was just really weird. She had an old monkey, and this, like, predates Michael Jackson or any of that stuff.
Right. I think that's where he got it from.
It's very likely. A nice touch that I really liked. Am I whispering more than I need to?
Yeah.
Okay. and then...
just for the record, we're recording this later at night, and we're
burning the midnight oil, because we have that kind of commitment to you, our audience member.
Yeah. And Ian's a little too paranoid about angry...
I just don't want to piss
angry,
anyone's...
relations of mine waking up and storming downstairs and hurling things at us.
Trying to beat me with like a broom.
Yeah.
Like a rat. Get out of here. You get. Okay, back to Sunset Boulevard. The pipe organ is awesome. I'm totally going to remember that because the wind would blow in and make... So it gives it like this weird... Because the whole house is just really cool. It's like a haunted house. I think the house plays almost like a major character in the movie. This rundown old, place. Then I made a few notes about. I made note the lady's paying for it, so it's like she's. It becomes this sort of story about an old lady trying to find love with this guy. It's sort of like a gigolo story. There's no locks in the house because she's suicidal. That was interesting.
Right. What do you feel about the relationship with the butler? And her.
That's very interesting because he was like a former director he married her and then.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but they don't reveal that he's a former director until near the end.
They don't reveal that he was married to her until
right,
the end either.
Right, right. And he kind of then lets this guy know.
He lets him know both pieces, yeah.
And he kind of, you almost think that he would say, this is information that would have been helpful months ago. You could have informed me about the craziness. Yeah. And
there's interesting concepts about being a writer in terms of like what's true and all that. Made a note that he goes for his buddy's girl, so he deserves to die. I don't know.
Okay.
If he had a pretty big, if you already know he's going to die, I'm like, he's making a move on his girl. Though it's all kind of playful and weird. It's like they're pretending to be characters, but there's clearly something sort of there, and he doesn't seem to care that it's his friend's fiance or whatever, which makes him like morally
sure
whatever. Not that I'm.
It makes him a noir protagonist.
Indeed.
It has, I think, it has a fantastic direction, which you would expect. It has really brilliant performances. I think that if you go into it thinking, most people when they think of noir think of what? Detective type stuff.
They think most of the hard-boiled detective.
Yeah. Most of the time. It's not always like that, because there are a great deal of noirs that really have nothing to do with the detectives, but
generally a crime, I think, is the key thing.
Yeah, a crime and somebody makes a bad choice along the way. Generally the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually something that has to do with it. They're almost tragedies.
The protagonists are all the traditional anti-hero. They're, because they're morally in flux, and it's necessary for them to be that way because they deal with the quote-unquote urban detritus, you know, that the people of the city that are the criminals and the low lives, but they also have to bridge that gap with the law and order and the real police officers.
Yeah.
So they're susceptible to the temptations of that underworld.
I think that thinking about that, you go into the film. If you haven't seen that before, you watch a lot of other noirs. You go into it thinking, I've seen the cover of this. I've seen clips of this. This can't be that type of movie.
Yeah, the cover's got this image of a woman.
And so I think that if you go in with certain expectations, you'll be surprised, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised because it ends up fulfilling expectations that you didn't have for it.
It's very cutting edge.
It
like
is.
I was
it totally
saying,
is. Yeah.
There's some weird stuff going on in that movie that you would not have expected to happen. But at the same time, it's not replete with swearing and gratuitousness.
I mean,
it's able. It just goes to show that you can tell a mature, disturbing, strange story without, you know, throwing in pigs' heads and sex.
I think that you know, Billy Wilder. You could always count something good from Billy Wilder. I think as a director, and I think he might have won. He co-wrote it.
He co-wrote it.
He
won
an Oscar for that as well. but it, just the acting. I'm a big fan of William Holden. I always have been, and he was all you know one of my favorite.
Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah,
and
of course Wild Bunch. And I remember how struck I was by the performances. And I'm generally not someone who cares too much about acting in films because there are films. I rewatched Sexy Beast last week, and that is a movie where you can say that it is it's a film with a fantastic performance by Ben Kingsley. And it really is one of those movies where the whole thing is driven by him and you're enthralled and just completely awestruck kind of while you're watching him turn into this different person, mainly because you see Ben Kingsley is usually a quieter kind of slow burn type of guy staring at his enemy and letting them know that he's not going to stand for it, or in the case of something like Schindler's List or Gandhi, you know, the quiet reserved type who kind of reluctantly does something good. But in the case of Sexy Beast, for those of you who haven't seen it, this British crime film set in mostly in, I think, Spain, and the main guy is the head of the police in The Proposition, and Ray Winstone, that's it, Ray Winstone, and Ian McShane, the guy from Deadwood, is in it. Just great performances all around, but Ben Kingsley is this guy who is sent by Ian McShane's character to convince Ray Winstone to come in on this one last heist, even though Winstone has retired. And so Ray Winstone is completely happy with his new life. He's grown fat and tan, and is very happy with his wife.
He made it out.
His friends.
He's
he made it out.
Of
and
sort of a mid-range heistman or whatever you want to call
and
it.
And Kingsley is the opposite. He comes to get him back. Kingsley is bald, obviously.
What's his name in that
skinny
character? Something fantastic.
Oh, Kingsley's name is something like Don, I think. It goes by Don.
don't they have a different? Maybe it is just Don. And
it's
they,
just Don.
The way
yeah.
they say it, it's just what's up with Don?
Well, Gary, the main guy is named Gary, but they everyone calls him Gal.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, Gal is short for Gary, and the performance from Kingsley is like. It just becomes like almost a play through most of it. The third half turns into Winston actually goes back to England and does the heist and this and that, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. But the first two-thirds, well, especially the second act, are dominated by Kingsley.
He's not even there in that first third.
He isn't.
And he's just
not,
talking
and he's
about
not
him.
There through most of the third act. He is shown in bits and pieces. But it's just him absolutely dominating every scene he's in. As an actor and as the character as well, and it's just one of those performances where that blows you away. And I usually don't see that in movies, and I usually don't rant about them.
It's definitely a neo-noir. Sexy
yeah,
beast.
Totally, absolutely. And it's
crime.
It's very and it's stylishly done. It's very.
It's got surreal elements. I think good noirs usually have some aspect
yeah.
of surreal, like we just talked about in Sunset Boulevard. But it's got that rock that just that boulders rolls down
yeah.
right when he's talking on the
just
phone.
Just random stuff happens kind of in the beginning. It's not random. It has something to do with the plot and everything. But it's just that's one of those ones where if you took him and that performance out of there and put someone else in, that may have just been some forgettable film. And I generally don't ever think that about a movie. I think the most important thing about a movie is all around execution. That can forgive a whole multitude of sins, including plot problems, acting problems, various directing or editing problems. If the entirety of the thing is good looking, entertaining, you forget about the problems right after they've happened. I mean, for instance, we got Batman Forever in the background. Batman Begins. If you look really carefully, there's inconsistencies. There are some problems with character. There's a few lines that probably shouldn't be in there and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it's presented in such a way that you're just kind of, the first time you watch it, you're kind of just in awe because it was just very, very well made, very well done. Just worked to just perfection, basically, as an art form, as the superhero movie. And it does everything a movie like that needs to, and it's got the style, and it's got the right actors playing the right roles for
yeah.
the most part. And, then if you look at this one, for instance, Batman Forever, you've got all the wrong actors. It's far too campy. You can just keep going with all these problems it has. And there may be one or two fantastic performances in it. I don't think so. I don't remember there ever being any fantastic performances in Batman Forever. But if it's presented well, you can kind of forgive them. And when I was 15 or whatever this came out,
I didn't think it was that bad.
No, I thought this was great, and I especially loved the soundtrack.
Yeah, the soundtrack. That's
really
a good
you sound. Couldn't finish Batman and Robin.
No, I didn't.
Well,
finish
that's on you.
I know.
You couldn't finish it. How do you not finish a superhero movie?
I finish almost everything I watch, but I couldn't finish Batman.
Because
Robin.
It was bad.
I guess
or because
so.
You like had to leave or something.
No, I was watching it on VHS some afternoon, and I was just like, I'm going to do something else now. And I don't do that. I don't have a life. I'm busy trying to figure out better ways to put candles out with my hands.
Yeah, well, you do have a full slate of
candle
things
putting
going
out,
on.
Yes.
Yeah. Getting back to Sunset Boulevard, that has a combination of all the right pieces, and it's not even that it's just so well made that it covers up problems, because I think it really doesn't have many problems. I'm sure you can think of some since you've seen it more recently, but after I watched it, I got that feeling I got only a few other times after seeing a certain movie for the first time. First time I saw Casablanca, I was blown away. First time I saw The Godfather, I almost felt like that, but I was a little bored. There are a few others that I'm just stunned by afterwards, and not just like in a visceral way. Like I saw Wild Bunch and I was stunned because of the beginning, and the ending, and then you watch it more times and it reveals things. But certain movies, you've seen Casablanca, right?
No.
Oh my gosh.
I know. My literacy
yeah.
knows no bounds.
But Casablanca is something where like it wasn't even a case of like lowered expectations or anything, because I've always been told that was such a fantastic film, and I've seen the top 100 lists from all the different organizations, and it's always up there. It's either that or Citizen Kane, Trading
yeah.
Places, this and this and this.
It's and like K2 and Everest.
close, yeah. No.
No.
And you watch it and you just come away with the sense that this it was it's such a perfectly crafted story, and the performances and the time and the way it's shot, the stage it's set on with the fog and the you know the final airport
the exotic
scene,
location
all these things just everything about it like. And that's really a noir too. If people put it in like a romance category, that's a noir. It is. His character is a mostly reprehensible guy who kind of comes around.
He's a club owner. He interacts with with people of shady characterization, and he sort of bridges that gap.
It's just really like you know those are the movies that you remember, and they don't. It's not that you can't say that they don't make them anymore because I think you see films like that, but it's just the older films. They did that without. They did it without profanity. They did it without explicit violence. They did it without nudity and things like that that are considered, you know, taboo in society for whatever reasons, for good reasons because you know you don't want kids and stuff seeing things like this. Mm-hmm. You could show a kid Casablanca if they're in the right mind frame, they'll absolutely enjoy it and they'll grow up thinking it's
you think like an 8-year old.
Oh yeah. I've heard. I mean, think about back then. I mean, mm-hmm. a kid would go see that, and I'm not sure how many kids actually went to go see that, but I mean. I know people who are in their 40s and 50s who talk about movies that were in the 70s that they saw when they were younger and they absolutely love them and it wouldn't be something that if I was their age I would have watched but people do you know
weird
I don't know I just think that certain films just hit you that way as soon as you've seen them you realize that this is one of the best movies I've ever seen and you don't feel that way about certain movies you haven't seen a few movies and thought that just instantly off the bat, not things after repeated viewing, or not things that you remember being great.
Well, like
they were
you mean
years
after
old.
Finishing it, not like in the middle of it, you're like, "Oh, this is awesome."
Oh, yeah, once it ends, you sit there and you think that was fantastic.
Oh God, I'm such a philistine because I haven't seen some of the real classics and I haven't gotten as much out of them. But no,
doesn't matter.
I would say so just two movies I can think of off the bat that I've had like a real like sense that I really enjoyed it and that like it was worth watching. Yeah. You know, I really enjoyed Trainspotting. By the time I got to the middle of it, I was like laughing and just enjoying the weirdness of it. I think it was because I was in a phase when I was really starting to get into like English electronic music, and that movie is replete with it. It's got Underworld and all that.
And you were also into heroin at that time, so
very big into heroin. Yeah. Still am in some cases. You can't tell. I mean, I've bulked up. I'm into heroin unchic.
I can see the makings of a track mark underneath your sleeve there. So.
Oh my. Heat. Heat is probably one of my favorite movies, just bar none. It's a cop and robber movie. It's really stylized. It's set in L.A. It's Michael Mann, made in 1995. Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. Everybody knows it. It's also got a pretty good cast. It's a pretty basic storyline, but it's also a noir. It's got sort of this duality of the cop and the robber, and you know, like who's going to live, who's going to die. Does it really matter? Also, a really awesome soundtrack. I think. I don't know. For me, that is a big part of what I really enjoy about watching things visually is the soundtrack. If the soundtrack is awesome. It really mounts the song. First, I wrote everything's Jake now because I guess saying Jake used to be like in the 20s and 30s was like you'd say things were cool.
What?
You just okay? So, for example, just ask me how's it going, Ian? How was today?
How was today, Ian?
Oh, it was fine. Everything's Jake.
Everything's Jake.
Robert Redford says it like 15 times in that movie.
In The Sting.
In The Sting. Everything's Jake. No, it's cool. Everything's Jake. It's kind of like a dismissive. Yeah, everything's fine.
So you don't find, let me ask you, you still haven't seen, I remember from the AFI thing, so you watched The Sting, which I definitely want to talk about in a minute here, but you had mentioned the AFI thing that you hadn't seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Kid. I still haven't seen that.
And what I tend to do is now, I mean, I saw The Sting when I was much younger, and then I saw Butch Cassidy after I realized that it was the same director.
Two lead actors, Paul Newman and Robert Redford.
If there's a movie that I see that is done by generally the same people, mostly the same people
that you enjoy,
and it's also very highly up there, then I will rush out to see it as soon as I see the other one, or rent it, or whatever I have to see it. And you didn't obviously didn't have the desire to.
No, it wasn't a desire issue. I just happened. A friend of mine had this thing, and I said, "Hey, I borrowed it from him."
I see.
And I also have The Secret of NIMH, which I'm going to watch at some point. Yeah. Which is because I remember it really being weird when I was a kid.
It is.
I thought about Butch Cassidy as I was watching The Sting, thinking, well, I need to see that too at some point. You've got a good point. I try to do that. Usually I'm more that way about directors. Like, I'll just decide it's time for me to watch a bunch of the certain directors so I can at least say I've seen their stuff. Like, I did that with Kurosawa. I didn't do that with Fellini, though. I did get 8.5 because I had seen
Fellini is harder to do that with because the films are more obtuse. And
yeah.
You know, you can do that with Kurosawa because they're generally...
There's a bunch of awesome
they're basically
movies.
Big Hollywood films that happen to have been made in Japan.
They have a different pacing to them.
They do have a different pacing, but you grow up thinking, oh, this, you know, you think of foreign films because of, like, basically, you think of French films when you think of foreign films? I do. I think of, when someone says foreign films,
you think of French
I
new
first
wave?
Think of French films.
Like and the new wave, though?
Not
like
always
Godard
new wave. Not
and
always new wave.
Handheld
even more modern ones. I've seen a couple of more modern French films. And before the big, you know, I don't know. Maybe it was just a misconception of mine, but I would always think that this is some boring crap where there's a bunch of people naked walking around a house and talking about how he wants to leave her for the 14-year-old girl down the street.
Or Jules and Jim, which I can't stand.
You don't like Jules and Jim, huh?
I didn't like that movie.
I thought it was pretty good.
I don't know. It bored me.
I'm not a huge fan of the new wave stuff, but...
Yeah, I like some of it, but...
A lot of talking. Breathless was good. You like
Breathless like has the 20-minute scene that's just yammering in an apartment. I've seen most of it. I think I've seen it. I don't know. It's been a while. Do you really want to talk about con movies for a bit then?
Go ahead and mention your framework for it.
Okay.
Let's not go into huge detail. But.
Okay. Well, okay. Usually the con is it's one guy who's coming up in the ranks. In this case, it's Robert Redford. I'll just break down the plot of The Sting and then you'll see how it relates to so many other con movies that have followed it. So Robert Redford is sort of a mid-level con artist. He cons the wrong guy who happens to be working for some dirty cops and this big crime guy. So big crime is bad. Little crime, being a con artist, if it's a Robin Hood scenario, especially if it's against actual criminals that are killers.
He's not hurting anyone.
Exactly. And as retribution for that, Rob Redford's partner who trained him, Luther, gets killed. Then Luther is... Redford ends up finding the guy that Luther worked with, who the Paul Newman character. And he starts to train him to set up a really big sting operation, you know, a big con on this crime guy who's played by Robert Shaw. Robert Shaw is all right, but he's not as awesome as he was in Jaws.
What's weird is that I remember Robert Shaw more clearly. When someone says Robert Shaw, I think of The Sting. I don't instantly think of Jaws, even though that's the iconic one for him.
It's set in 36 Illinois, so it's still right there in the Depression. So it's got that whole mentality of the little guy versus the big guy. I like this quote here that Newman tells Redford. He says, "Drink gin with the marks," because he can't tell if you cut it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he shows up pretending to be drunk and wins over on Robert Shaw, and that's how things all get started. But the thing is, it requires such a massive infrastructure and group of guys that come together to help bust this big crime guy. It's like crazy. It's kind of unbelievable.
And every time I see it, I always think at the end of the film, how much profit did they actually make? Because they had to pay all those guys.
Yeah.
But you also think of the what's the dollar amount they end up getting away with?
They get $500,000.
$500,000, which back then is probably a tantamount to something like 15, 20 million. I don't know.
Maybe
more, maybe less. I don't know. Somewhere in that sort of like inflation type range.
It's a lot of money.
My parents were talking the other day about how they remember as kids back in the early 60s that gasoline was 25 cents a gallon or something like that. So I mean, think about that change. I mean, I know gas is different because there was a huge jump after the oil crisis in the 70s and the one in the 80s.
Things have changed.
But in just terms of general inflation, you know, you can look at Jane Austen films, and there's actually I took a bunch of English literature classes, and the teachers always gave little handy charts, and one of them handed out bookmarks that had a chart of what pounds were in certain Jane Austen times, and also Shakespearean and various other P.G. Woodhouse, stuff like that, early 1920s, the late 1800s, whenever these are supposed to be. And then showing you in today's dollars what that would be. And today's dollars have even changed since when I had these bookmarks 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, like when somebody's like, oh, I
a pound's still about $2 American, right?
I think it's either more or less now. It has something to do with, you know, the euro changed
that
also.
Euros gets us again.
But, you know, you could basically say that if somebody had, like, £100 a year allowance or something like that, mm-hmm. that was something like, you know, some ridiculous amount of money, like $85,000 a year for something like that, which is, you know, enough to get by on. They were talking about how that, oh, that
wasn't
much.
It was a big operation.
Like exactly. So with the sting,
they were very likely able to get everyone to do it, but everyone had to agree to do it against this crime boss and on the off chance it might not work.
Yeah.
So it seemed like you got the impression they were all the good con artists. They were all coming together because their friend Luther had been killed by this guy and they were going to get him. And they were going to bust him and that was going to be that. I would say, so here's the gimmick for the con. Usually, it's a group of well-interested people that have to pretend to double-cross each other to get one over on a big, major crime guy. Movie Confidence that came out with Ed Burns and Rachel Weisz.
The most forgettable of con movies,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, probably. And Dustin Hoffman, that was the same sort of thing, you know?
My problem with this whole thing, though, is that there's a few con movies that I can talk about that can compare this to, but a vast majority of them are David Mamet films, and those follow particular type of...
You're thinking like House of Games and
stuff?
I'm
thinking of House of Games. I'm thinking of Spanish Prisoner. I'm thinking of...
Spanish Prisoner is awesome.
Heist.
Heist is pretty
yeah,
good.
You know, those all have crosses, double crosses, triple crosses, quadruple crosses. Heist has almost too many.
Heist is like...
Twist after... Like a lot, there's like five endings.
Would you
that
say
like
that was
twisty,
the last
twisty, twisty, twisty.
Con movie that he did?
We'll see. He did Spartan. He
oh,
did.
Spartan wasn't really
that
a
wasn't
con
a com.
Movie.
I'm just thinking of all the ones he did
movie.
After that. He did Spartan,
He's
which was fantastic.
Just doing the,
I love Mamet. There's almost nothing that I've seen by him.
I like Spartan too.
What's weird is that when he came up off the success of Wingard, Glenn Ross, and Buffalo 66, which were both not Buffalo 66. What's that one?
Oh yeah, I know what you mean. It's like it's
Buffalo
Nickel or
Nickel,
something.
Yeah. And
the movie's got Dennis Franz and
and they were both plays that he wrote, and neither of those movies were directed by him, so they're different stylistically from his movies. You can still tell it's his dialogue, but the actors are like acting, like method acting.
Yeah.
And David Mamet's thing is, don't raise an eyebrow unless I tell you to do it as an actor. He said your job is. He's written books on this that piss actors off. That says your job
action.
As an actor is to. Is to read the dialogue that I wrote and state it with a blank face. That's what he says. The dialogue makes you, is what he says, which is the most arrogant thing a writer can say.
It's pretty bad. I mean,
he can get away with it. He can get away with it.
I don't think I got a lot of that from Spartan. House of Games, it's heavy-handed. You're watching it, and you're like, there's something weird with this acting.
Oh, totally.
Spanish Prisoner has a lot of that.
That was his first film he directed.
Spanish Prisoner has a lot of that. I think a lot of it's Rebecca Pigeon. She still even does that in. She's in The Unit, and she does that.
Is he still married to her?
He might.
They were. They might have gotten divorced.
Sure. I know that he was married to Lindsay Krause or whatever from House of Games.
Also a bad actor.
Also, like a judge on Law and Order SVU. I like a lot of Mamet stuff. Did you see the newest one? I don't know if he directed. I don't think he directed it. Edmund with William H. Macy.
I didn't.
It was a neo-noir, really kind of creepy and weird.
Seen State and Maine, all that stuff.
I like State and Maine, that's fine.
With Running Scared, it was kind of almost one of the first offerings of the genre. You can't really say for sure what's the first, because if you try hard enough, you can find ridiculous action movies from any decade that kind of fits in this sort of framework.
I think you can, but I think the thing that I'm latching onto about, as you're trying to say, the sort of new generation, is that it's
a subgenre
of
the action.
It's nonstop.
It is nonstop.
Shoot 'em Up was a 90-minute gunfight with very few breaks. Crank was obviously nonstop.
Yeah.
The Transporter movie, well, at least the second one, to me, seemed very nonstop. The first one I saw bits of, and there was a lot of slow moments there.
The Transporter one, I don't fit into that category, and this is why. Because if you take Jason Statham out and you put Jackie Chan in, it's The Fog, the new one.
Uh-huh.
The Fog is on in the background, the bad version. You take Jason Statham out, you put Jackie Chan in, mm-hmm. it's just a Jackie Chan movie. That's it. It's a guy who...
does some weird tricks with his feet.
Does a bunch of crazy stunts and beats a bunch of guys using tools around him.
Finds some girl. Yeah.
That's what that is. It is nonstop, I don't think that's not the only stipulation to put it in this subgenre. I think it has to be gratuitously violent. I think it has to be, in a way, know it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to present it to you like it's going to be some Oscar caliber stuff.
So there's a lack of earnestness on the part of the filmmakers.
But they believe that it's awesome, and it's not so tongue in cheek that they don't think that you will think that it's brilliant and fantastic and really entertaining. So Running Scared, and actually you were mentioning about the relentlessness of it. Running Scared, watching it again today, had more breaks for long pieces of dialogue than I remembered previously. If you remember, there's three or four times where they just stop and someone's in a car with someone else and says, listen, and then tells you a 5-minute long story about his past.
That's true. There's a little bit of that. And but it seems like there's always motion at very least. So like they are in a car when that's happening.
Sure.
There is some sort of sense of chase they're going. The music is thumping. The camera is constantly moving needlessly in some cases.
Yeah, you're right.
Not motivated by the action so much as to create this artificial sense of action because it's moving.
Yes. Okay, so in Running Scared, Paul Walker, the blonde Keanu Reeves, decides that he's... he doesn't decide anything. He's in with the mob. And he's asked to get rid of a gun.
Or so we think.
Sure. He's asked to get rid of a gun that was used to blow away a crooked undercover cop.
They croaked a few cops at the beginning of the movie. In a very chaotic scene that, constantly moving camera. There's no real establishing early in this movie. If you know anything about movies, there's no establishing shot or wide shot to convey a sense of the placement or anything.
Well,
it's a lot of close-ups,
it moves in from the credits,
moving,
and it's got the really stylized credits.
Yeah, I noted that too. Odd credit sequence, stylized. The whole movie, at least a large portion of it, is very orange. Even it's very high. It's using some kind of high contrast stock, or maybe it's just all digital filters.
I think there was filters, and it was really low lighting for the most part. They did that really grainy thing. But that's the thing. But this movie had an abundance of style, I think, that carried it through, because you can look at it and kind of be titillated by just the way it looks while these things are going on.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the action is stupid or the lines are stupid, which they frequently are. There's one completely ridiculous part, which you guys laughed at when we watched it earlier, that I did the first time I saw it as well, and I instantly thought, this is the dumbest movie I've ever seen, which is when... he comes home and his kid and him are talking about hockey.
Nicky, your favorite.
Yeah,
your favorite
Nicky,
guy.
and they high five extremely awkwardly.
Yeah.
And the look on Paul Walker's face is one of just complete and utter retardation, like he's autistic or something. And he slaps his kid's hand and says, "Red ice," and they're both so.
That might
psyched.
Be the title for this one.
Red
but
ice,
I don't know.
Man.
We had that whole break. I might make that a separate podcast.
Yeah, sure. And. You know, Walker is terrible, but, I mean, the only thing that's asked of him in this movie is you run around, you say the F word a lot, and you...
F-bombs are being dropped,
you
like...
You yell in every opportunity.
They're being dropped like the spores in that episode of Voltron where Link had... Not Link, but Kyle had to go off to the other planet, and then... anyway, they're being dropped like spores on that episode of Voltron, the F-bombs.
Okay, they're being dropped like spores.
From that episode of Voltron.
From that episode of Voltron. You know the one.
You do, Internet.
So... Running Scared, anyway, had this abundance of style that carried it through the rough parts.
God Hates New Jersey, I wrote that.
Oh, New Jersey is the worst place on earth, according to movies. It's got this fairy tale motif that you almost can't tell except for the final credit sequence. If
the
you
cops
really
are literally
looking.
Dirty.
Cops are literally dirty. They don't wash their hands once they leave bathrooms. Everyone's dipping their faces into toilets and hands into toilets. Even Paul Walker's wife, who's the cleanest looking person in the thing, sticks her hand down his pants at one point, the backside of his pants, which I assumed was all sweaty and stained
with
fecal matter.
That scene did not make any sense in that movie at all.
What do you want? They wanted to put a little bit of a hanky panky in there.
I guess.
Okay, so we'll get back to your opinion of Running Scared, but first of all, let's give a quick overview of
Indeed.
newest offering of the genre, which is Shoot 'em Up.
With Clive Owen and the ravishing Monica Bellucci.
Sure. Clive Owen is an infinitely better actor than Paul Walker, and that's saying something because Clive Owen is generally kind of wooden and doesn't emote much and doesn't really play different characters ever. He plays the same character very closely in every movie, even something like Closer. He's still playing someone who's stone-faced, speaks in the same voice.
He's a stoic guy.
Yeah, totally.
In his characters. And so in that sense, he's almost like a leading man character actor.
Yes.
Because that's like another form of the anti-hero or whatever's big with protagonists is a form of stoicism. He's got to either learn to love or who knows, whatever.
Sure.
Care for the child in the case of this film, maybe.
So his task is to keep this baby alive. He doesn't know why, but he's keeping this baby alive because he's got this deep down good soul. Even though he kills, how many people would you say in this movie? They're all bad guys, but he still...
Or bad by association. It's the Return of the Jedi rule, if you know.
Kills a bunch of mother's sons. They're all mother's sons.
Yes. Some of them might be clones.
I'd say he kills nearly 100. I might go so far. Maybe not that many. But remember when he's flying down... Falling down that rope that the staircase is going around.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just going, and there's just guys going, whoa, whoa. And then he goes through this whole thing. Paul Giamatti's following him, wants the baby dead. Clive Owen doesn't know why. He's British. He's in America. He eats a lot of carrots. Shoots a lot of people.
The Bugs Bunny motif.
Yeah. Shoots a lot of people. Some violence. But very lacking, especially in directorial and cinematographical style.
Yeah, it doesn't. The mise-en-scene is pretty lacking. There's not a lot of set design per se. It's dingy. It's dark. It's, you know, it's some back section of a town where it'd be like if you took where they lived in Fight Club and just made it multiple blocks where you never see police officers.
Yeah, but without anything to do with anything close to Fincher's style. So it's almost unfair to even include Fight Club.
I'm not saying.
I know what you're saying about
style.
The part
it's
of town
just,
and everything like that. Yeah,
it's just a rundown factory industrial.
Okay,
part
so
of
I've given an overview of both. Where do you, what do you have to say about? But go ahead and start with just Shoot 'em Up and just say. I mean, I think you obviously felt as I did.
I think Shoot 'em Up. I was pretty disappointed with it because, well, I need to at least be able to connect with the story. I need to be able to go. Essentially, at this point, what I'm looking for in my action movies is I'm looking for a protagonist that's going to change a little bit. It's going to end up, you know, if he is kind of a bad guy, he'll become kind of a good guy and do the right thing, and maybe he dies. I don't know. I don't care about that. But the motivation for the sort of general, the whole plot was really weird. It has something to do with clones and some guy running for president, some anti-gun thing that they threw in kind of last minute and got real heavy.
And the stuff about the guy running for president was didn't even make sense. We were talking about this after we left the movie, that the kind of little plot contrivances they put in there to keep driving along the characters' motivations didn't make sense. It was one of those action movie things where somebody says something really complicated, thinking that, oh, the audience member will just kind of go past this and assume that this plus this equals this, when it really is just gibberish.
Yeah, so it lacked that. So story-wise, already I threw it out on some level. I'm like you, though. If it's interesting style-wise, there's something going on there. There was a lot of choreography in terms of the gunfighting. There was that, but there was nothing else to it. Like you said, there wasn't really interesting camera movement or camera
That choreography or wasn't captured in an exciting way.
No,
it
wasn't. It
didn't exploit the choreography at all.
No, it didn't. So that movie, it failed, in my opinion, in just about every respect. Almost more so because it had some really good actors in it that I just didn't know why
were
there.
Yeah. I assume just because they thought it would be fun to do something like that.
Probably exactly what
Paul Giamatti will never, ever have another chance to be in a movie like this. So
let's hope he gets a chance to be in another movie.
It wasn't that bad.
Back to... okay, so I pretty much give it a giant thumbs down.
Okay.
If we did a star system, I'd
but
give
before
it like
we
a
go
half
on,
star.
Before we go on, I think the biggest sin it committed was constant... almost winking at the camera with the most retarded punchlines, not even like Schwarzenegger punchlines, but just retarded things said after things, the rolling of eyes.
Yes.
And a problem I had, which was constant overuse of popular modern rock songs. And the most stunning thing to me was that there was a Nirvana song off In Utero. in the first 5 minutes. And I didn't even realize that. I don't think I remember many Nirvana songs being licensed to be in movies to begin with. So this is probably something to do with Courtney Love, I think, since she's still executor of the estate of Kurt Cobain and all his works.
I love Courtney Love.
But Running Scared, before we get into that, I'll just mention this, though. It was an entirely orchestral score.
I don't remember there being a lot of actual rock in it.
And I don't think there was, except for in times when there was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And
it was diegetic. It was all.
Yeah, it was.
It was never just like, hey, this is a Mountain Dew commercial.
Exactly.
Watch this.
So go ahead to what you were saying there.
Okay, so Running Scared didn't work as a movie to me for many reasons. But I'm going to do the whole thing where I argue about, you know, my dialectic process.
Sure.
I've got a note about the subplot. There was this subplot all of a sudden that came in that was very creepy that had to do with this incest kiddie porn thing where the kids gets kidnapped, because it basically becomes obvious that it's like a collection of fairy tales.
Sure.
And in that sense, I started to go, well, this story
was much more interesting.
Was much more. Not only was the subplot much more interesting, but had some real tension in it, and I actually was watching it then and caring about it. To some degree.
And as you kept mentioning throughout the film, if this had followed the children,
yes,
it followed their characters, it would have been infinitely more interesting, just as a story.
If it was supposed to be a fairy tale, then it would have followed the children, and it would have been more grounded in that. Instead of following the Paul Walker character, who's this dingy guy that you don't care about until the very end when they throw it in needlessly.
Yeah.
I mean, spoiler alert, but what do I care? We've spoiled everything we've talked about here.
Undercover
cop. We spoiled
cop.
Watchmen, so I don't give a shit.
Yeah, undercover cop.
He's an undercover cop for 12 years. His wife doesn't even know.
Yeah.
His son doesn't
even know.
Just
thought he was in the mob.
You know, so the whole time.
By the way, if he was an undercover cop for 12 years, that means he would have started when he was, like, 20. Because he can't be older, much older than 30.
Yeah,
in
it was
film.
Something pretty crazy. Yeah. I wrote, what a twist. And then I wrote something about the ice capades, because the whole end sequence, which is kind of cool.
It was. It had some, I'm not going to say inventive action, but the kind of standard action that's in it is really amped up by the overly stylish directorial. Yeah. Everything that was lacking in Shoot 'Em Up was overboard in this one.
Oh, yeah, and that I had a problem with that. But you're right, at least they did it.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing about, I would give Running Scared a higher appraisal, because at least for like a pedagogical value, you can look at it and say, well, if they'd made it about the kids, this could have been a good movie.
And there's more into it.
And
you,
so you can
discuss
see pieces about it, yeah.
You can discuss these different things afterwards. The only thing
fairy
that,
tale thematics that
exactly.
flow throughout
And I think the
story.
Only thing that they tried to put in there that was even close to something thematically was the Bugs Bunny thing, which is almost explicitly
stated. This is in
Shoot
'Em Up now.
In Shoot 'Em Up, yeah. Which is almost explicitly stated. He says, what's up, Doc? Giamatti's character says, you're a wascally wabbit.
Mm-hmm.
He's constantly biting on the carrots.
Carrots.
Giamatti's ringtone is the...
Valkyries.
Yeah, that one where, you know, it's the kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit thing. Yeah. All Bugs Bunny cartoon stuff. That is all, you know, that's what they were, like, you know, that's your jumping off point right there. Yeah. Bugs Bunny? For a ridiculously violent action film,
there was
where,
no anvils or safes dropping. If they'd thrown in a couple piano drops, then it would have worked. I'm serious. I would give it 4 stars instead of half.
No, you wouldn't. You would have walked out of the theater along with that old woman who couldn't stand the scene where
Monica Bellucci was breastfeeding that guy.
Well, was that when she walked out?
That was probably about when. That would probably when all the women would have walked out.
I would be hoping.
I
would hope
myself.
That would have stayed until. Clive Owen is banging Monica Bellucci while shooting and killing 8 guys who are trying to, and she gets off on that. She doesn't even open her eyes because she's in the throes of ecstasy while he's killing these men who are invading their hotel room while they're banging.
Yeah, that movie, just like I said, 90-minute gunfight.
And so the reason why I was even interested in this subgenre to begin with was because of Running Scared, because I watched it thinking, this movie looks really bad, let's see what it's about. And I came away thinking, there is such an emphasis of style over substance that it just becomes so fascinating to me, because it is a train wreck, it is a failure, but it's a likable one to me. It's a likable failure to me, and I appreciate the effort they put in the style.
Yeah.
And it was inventive stylistically, and there was
I
it was
see.
Overused. It was overused, but it was inventive. He took a little bit of David Fincher stuff. He took a little bit of this, a little bit of that. The gritty, the grainy, the almost like Janusz Kaczynski, Spielbergian.
Wonder. I don't know. I'm looking at it the whole time, and then when we found out that the writer-director was the guy that did the film The Cooler,
The Cooler,
which was a much smaller, kind of more intimate story, more very
character
indie
study.
And character study, which was I thought it was a good movie. It wasn't. It was kind of derivative of that indie loser guy finds a girl, whatever crime stuff happens. But it was still a reasonable movie. And then that whole subplot and things, I just almost wonder if it got reworked. It got retooled to make this, you know, sell point to the guys and sell point to the chicks of this hottie guy, Paul Walker, or whatever the hell he's supposed to be, as the main character. Because who would want to watch a movie about a kid? And plus it would be much more dark if it were really, like, the kid's POV.
Totally.
Because it's like, wow, you've made a kid's movie that's rated hard R, filled with the F-bomb and prostitutes getting, you know...
You're absolutely right. That I now that you say that, I'm probably thinking that that might have been a possibility, because I think that that guy is smarter than that.
But you never know, though,
because you see, they don't put out extended special feature DVDs for movies like that. They put them out for
Sometimes they do. It's really weird, though.
And the thing is, like, when they do put those out, then you can hear the director say, they, you know, the studio cut out 35 minutes of this or something like that, and, or put in this scene that I didn't
want
there.
It was long. It was like 2:05. It was longer than it needed to be.
I didn't know if it was... I think
Shoot 'Em Up was...
Shoot 'Em Up was shorter.
Shoot 'Em Up was shorter, but I mean, in terms of... This is also why it was a more complex and better movie. That whole subplot, if they had taken that whole subplot out, it would have made it more general action-y movie, but you would have missed the subplot, which was the good part.
And the subplot also had some of the strangest stylistic touches. The color scheme, it suddenly changed to almost a different movie. The color scheme...
It was a little crisper, too.
Yeah, the aspect of the playroom with the plastic sheeting on the ground. She finds all the weapons. She kills those two people. You know, that's the extent of the growth of, and change of her character.
Yeah, and her character actually ends up
She finds something worth committing these crimes, a crime that she feels is kind of worthwhile and, you know, is justified, blah, blah, blah. But then, as I mentioned before in the last podcast, there's this moment where the kid Oleg, who's Russian-born, I guess... but speaks
no,
with
he's
American
an
American accent. Yeah,
you're
he's an American.
American.
You're an American.
Say you're American because you're born in the United States.
Paul
so
Walker, Oscar moment.
I kept thinking he kept getting confused between a Jersey accent and like a Boston accent.
Oh, none of them did Jersey accents.
Yeah.
I think the only ones he even tried were the Super Mafia Mook guys.
Yeah.
Hey, what do you think about this, huh? Where they're kicking guys in the stomach. You know? And Chaz Palminteri, of course, can do it because that's what he is. He's in New York.
Chaz Palminteri is fantastic.
But this kid is in the bathroom trying to call the next-door neighbor. The woman and in the background, there's these kind of like frost windows, so you can't see in, but you can see the light outside the bathroom in the hallway. And as these two people who kind of kidnapped this kid are walking back and forth, the shadows are extremely wicked witchy, extended long fingernails, hunched over. When the guy walks by, he has like demonic elf ears almost.
Well, he's made to be like the Nosferatu.
Totally, yeah, absolutely, and. I think that's the moment when I first saw the film where I was like, I got shivers. I was like, that is so creepy and so out of place for this film. And I was just instantly fascinated. I honestly am more intrigued by movies that fail spectacularly than something that kind of safely gets by and afterwards you think that was a good movie. Okay, so where do you think this genre can possibly go from here?
I don't think it's hard to have a good formula to make it a good movie.
Sure. I think the subgenre, though, like we go through the subgenre. Mm-hmm. The torture porn thing came, was popular, peaked very quickly, and then was done with, and people are sick of it.
Do you think that they killed it in a weird way? Like, do you think Grindhouse and things served to kind of parody, tongue-in-cheek it, like in the same way that Scream did with certain horror movies?
No,
people say Scream killed certain horror movies, even though that
Grindhouse
didn't end up happening.
Very specifically and literally... was just doing a grindhouse thing, and it was what it was supposed to be.
Okay,
I think that the reason why we know that that's dead now is because Hostel 2 performed much more poorly than the first one.
There's
did.
A lot of like
and,
complexity in that though, in terms of the way it was released and stuff.
Captivity, and you know that was extremely controversial in the media
because of that billboard,
because the billboard and the ads for it and everything like that. Just completely inappropriate, and it still didn't generate, because people, I mean, if it was for a PG-13 film, and people felt like they could still go see it and not be grossed out, but when it's obviously going to be some ridiculously, you know, offensive rated R thing about torture and rape and you know, kidnapping women with roofies and tying them
pieces
in your basement.
Of eight. There was no pieces of eight in it. I don't think so. All bets are off. We'll be right back. Sneakers. I liked Sneakers, the Robert Redford spy movie. I had Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, Sydney, Poitier. I was going to try to just commit to one.
Poitier.
And our friend...
say it like he says it. Sydney Poitier.
Sydney Poitier. I did almost nail that, didn't I?
Our good friend Ben Kingsley.
Ben Kingsley. No meatloaf.
No, there's no Ben Kingsley in it. It's the guy who looks like Ben Kingsley.
No, that's Ben Kingsley. He's in Sneakers.
Yeah, you're right.
IMDb
now. No, you're right. I own it.
Oh, you own it?
Yeah. That's actually one of the few owners movies here. That I own.
I'd almost feel like
I don't own many movies. Yeah.
I'd almost feel like watching. Anyway, I don't know if it's considered a bad movie. It's just not particularly popular. It fits in that esoteric category you were talking about, you know? It's not particularly popular. It just works for what it is. It's simple. It's kind of thrillerish, but not really. It's like PG-13. There's not a lot of. I watched it with my dad and my brother one
Friday night. It's got a good cast. I like actually David Strathairn is one of my favorite actors.
Yeah, David Strathairn is good.
Plays the blind guy. I think it's good that you brought this up because it's. I think this kind of almost fits into that con category because it's almost the same sort of thing where these guys are trying to, one of those things where like it's not a race against the clock, but it's this thing where. Even no matter how
there is a time
there is a little bit
somebody's gonna
like,
crack
it's one of those things where like no matter how well they plan it, you know something's gonna go wrong, but some ingenuity happens on their part and then they get through it.
Did I talk about Missing in Action 2, the beginning with Chuck Norris? Missing in Action 2 was the first I imagine every single kid in the 80s like pretty much watched nothing but Chuck Norris and ninja movies for a couple years there. And that was how I would assess time. Like, if I had to do something that I was not looking forward to, 90 minutes. 90 minutes is a Chuck Norris movie. It's just one Chuck Norris movie, and I can make it. I can make it through, this is just going to take one Chuck Norris movie, this gymnastics meet, because I did gymnastics when I was a kid. Little bio there.
Wait, you're kidding me.
No.
I don't think you're qualified to talk about pitching Woo.
Okay. No, Missing Action 2 is heavy-handed. It's like, they're in this Vietnam camp.
Okay.
They're POWs. They put a rat in a bag, and they tie it to his head. And then the only way he survives... We're a little punchy now, sorry. The only way he survives is to bite it and break its back. And I remembered that. Like, when I was a kid, I really remembered that. I'm like, that's disgusting. That's awful, but you have to do awful things if you want to survive. And that really struck me. There's also, when he's finally ready to escape, he grabs the rib cage of the, terrible Asian Vietnamese guy that's been, killing them all and giving people, flamethrower baths or something. And,
have a flamethrower bath, you.
Yeah, that's flamethrower awesomeness. It fits... I don't know. I haven't seen Rescue Dawn, and I know it would be ridiculous to compare the two.
I'm sure it would be.
It's a good movie. You should watch it. You should watch Missing in Action 2, the beginning. Chuck Norris even kind of works in it. He doesn't have to have a lot of lines, doesn't have to say or do a lot. It's all very visceral, kind of what's going on. It's not terribly gratuitous. I mean, it's got, things in it that are gross, but there's not a lot of gratuitous violence.
Okay.
So there you go. I defended Missing in Action 2.
Okay. The one I'm going to defend here is not really considered a bad movie or something like that. I think it's a little overlooked. The series of Jack Ryan films. The one I think is overlooked is Clear and Present Danger. And here's why. Because
it's overlooked? I remember that being here's popular.
It was popular, but if you watch on TV, the one that is constantly played...
Patriot Games.
Hunt for October is remembered because it's two big stars. It's Sean Connery and it's Alec Baldwin. First of all, let me start this by saying I've read a bunch of Tom Clancy's books just because I like spy stuff. Mm-hmm. I like things about high-tech weaponry and in anything because it's like spy stuff has always intrigued me. I love James Bond movies. Crappy spy stuff, good spy stuff like Ronin, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Tom Clancy books piss me off because every good character... is a red-blooded American male who was the awesome star quarterback of his football team who banged the hot prom queen and made her his hot little wife, and they have...
Really?
No,
Ryan
every,
isn't that, though, is he?
He is. He is. He was a star football player. So he
got injured in a helicopter crash.
Right. But he was all
he
of this.
He got a doctorate and edited textbooks.
No, no, but I mean, have you...
He married a doctor.
Yeah, but he. But have you read, I mean, the books...
I just remember Red October, which establishes
right.
all of that.
Okay, but in the movie of Red October, they try to establish him as a nerd. They go back in Patriot Games in the movie and talk about how this other stuff. But if you read in the books...
Yeah.
He's exactly like all the other protagonists. I read like Rainbow Six, for instance, which has a bunch of those guys. Jack Ryan and the guy in Patriot Games, like John's, like he picks the most standard American names for these guys, and they're both guys who were the captains of the football team, and they banged and married the homecoming queen. These aren't likable characters to most people unless you're like a 65-year-old woman who's saying, "Oh, that's a good old-fashioned American boy," or something like that. Even though it's setting up this like male-dominant thing that I think is overpowering and not endearing to most Americans.
It's not an anti-hero. That's what
it's not an anti-hero.
He's not
anti-hero.
It's clean, clear president. No. He's considered the Boy Scout, and they talk about that.
Yes,
but not black and white, right and wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And there's great lines.
How dare you, sir?
But Harrison Ford brings this. You know, you never look at Harrison Ford, even in Indiana Jones and stuff, you never look at him and think, captain of the football team, bang the hot cheerleader.
That's what's good about him.
Exactly. He comes off as, like, almost goofy.
He's befuddled.
This, yeah.
And he's befuddled. He gets those
and
eyes.
He has this stunned look on his face. Something happens, and he just looks up with these totally confused eyes, and it's so endearing.
It's
you're like,
great.
You're like, this dude is like, dumber than me, almost. He's a smart guy.
No, he's in these crazy situations, and it's like... You actually, it's like almost believable for him to be
totally,
in those.
Totally. So in Clear and Present Danger, when he's having this battle with this guy, and he's trying to download something on this computer, and the guy is trying to cover
with
it
Kittredge
up.
Kittredge from the original Mission Impossible.
Exactly,
movie.
Yeah. And the guy's trying to cover it up, and then when he gets it, and he like walks over to the guy with victory in his face, like it's not like I'm a badass. It's like like this almost like nerdy thing.
Yeah.
Like he's that endearing a thing, but it's got that aspect to it. It's got this great like almost like. With all the office stuff, this like corporate thing going on that
it's got the intrigue, but it's layered and it's realistic.
And
it's like how it would actually happen.
And it's linked with this like Colombian assassination spy
illegal
drug
war
stuff.
Yeah.
And then he goes and gets involved with that. And there's these moments where like, you know, the things that are endearing about Harrison Ford's and Alec Baldwin's playing, you know, characterizations of Jack Ryan are that he's surprising people. He's coming up from behind, and he's surprising people with his knowledge, with his guts, because he's coming from behind, and he's not already in this leading position in life, you know.
Yeah.
And he almost seems surprised to be there, and like he doesn't deserve
he's
it,
a little
or, like he doesn't want to almost.
Yeah.
And then the Ben Affleck character here's how he's kind of introduced to the woman who he ends up. They're engaged, I think, in the Sum of All Fears. Which
Maybe.
Is the reboot thing because it's set in the present time.
Yeah, it's
and they're younger.
Weird.
But she goes, she's working in the hospital, and her friend goes, "Who, you know, the new boyfriend? What's he like?" And she's like, "Oh, he's awesome, you know." And she names the football team thing, all these things that like aren't, you know, the aren't things that we look for in a hero or something like that. It's because, you know, we want something emotional and something where like the decisions he makes are more important than what he's done on the football field and what cheerleaders he's banged. But then the next thing that comes out of the nurse's mouth is, what does he look like on a scale from 1 to 10? And the wife, the Ann Archer character, who's played by whoever it is, I forget who it is in Some of All Fears.
She just had a kid, I think.
Yeah, and she goes, he's an 11. Like, obviously.
This one goes to
obviously,
11.
Yeah, obviously this guy is the most attractive, awesome, badass guy in the world. And... You know, it's just not cool anymore.
Okay, so we're going to do pitches now. And as you remember, for the pitches, and we do not have the results yet for the other one, we will have those up. We're going to like to probably give about a month between, or a couple of weeks, to let our audience come together. Right now we've only got...
Come together in mass form.
Yes.
They can meet somewhere, coffee shops, fly across the nation to meet in an arcade or coffee shop and tabulate the results.
No, well,
and then present those to
they
us.
They know that they can email them to me.
Or do the boring thing.
IAN.strope@gmail.com and say which one they like best, Zach's or Ian's. or just describe it. And in the,
I don't like the tone of your voice when you said my name. You were obviously trying to lead the witness here.
Subject line, just say that it's about the feudal podcast, or to say, hey, your dumb podcast, your stupid pitches, or whatever, this one's my favorite, or they both suck, but which one sucks less? I mean, be somewhat constructive if you're going to be completely deconstructive. We're all about deconstruction, so it's cool. Okay, so I want to do this category. Last week's was, it was supposed to be period action movies, and I did Time Striker, the CG kids Tezuka sort of referential crazy movie that, and you did the one about Sir Isaac Newton busting counterfeiters.
Right. Gratuitous, violent.
Yes.
Yeah.
This week we're going
to try. Rolls an apple toward the edge of the cliff. The guy falls off.
Yes.
Gary Busey in a wig.
This week we're going to try to do. We're going to pitch two films that fit into what I've sort of loosely called the James L. Brooks comedy type stylings. Mainly because I'm thinking of movies that are. They have aspects of drama. They have more fleshed out characterization. A general beginning, middle, and end with a changing character. I'm thinking essentially of As Good As It Gets, you know, that's what I'm thinking of, that kind of comedy, which I thought was a pretty funny movie. Some people might just plain hate it, whatever, I don't care. This is to be opposed to, and we'll probably do this pitch later, a more like a Farley Brothers comedy, mm-hmm. which is just gag after gag, gross outs, and things like that. So, James L. Brooks type comedy, do you want to lead or do you want me to lead?
Well, here's the thing. Mine, once again, is extremely retarded. Did that work better last time because I went last, or do you want my extremely retarded one first, and then you can mellow it out with your strong actual movie pitch? Mine, I think, would be really good, mm-hmm. but I got to admit, I based the entire premise off the name that I came up with.
I'm trying to think, because it's a contest, if we always go the same way, will people always just vote for the last one they heard, or...
Okay.
I don't like the tone of your sigh there.
All right. No, I'm just preparing myself.
You want to stretch? Stretch it out? I could do with a leg stretch. Yeah. Okay.
I'm gonna save the.
You gonna save it?
I'm gonna save the title for the end because the title is the best part about this movie.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. A down on her luck, hot female lawyer, young. Kicked out of her law firm because, figure that out later, decides to start her own law firm at her own house because there are enough other people in the world who want recourse, legal action for things, for wrongs that have been done against them.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time she's, she entices these people to come because she's young, buxom beauty. And she decides she can entice people to her business because she will be a poolside lawyer. She can listen to people's claims while there's people hanging out by the pool, by the sauna, the hot stuff she has in the backyard, everything like that. At the same time,
this is at her house. Then she's got a pool.
Yeah, in her backyard. She got a pool, a jacuzzi, sauna, all this stuff.
She was at the top of her game. Like, she got fired. She was fired because of
something she did illegally at the firm without knowing it.
Okay.
Because there was another lawyer working with her that kind of goaded her into doing it. Anyway, the whole time she's also looking for love because her husband of 5 years was cheating on her with his own cousin, second cousin. So it's the little, you know, gray area thing there. Second cousin's legal, but it's still kind of gross and creepy. So that'll add a little interesting thing to it. By the way, the young woman, I would prefer to be played by Tara Reid. I want her to have a comeback. The husband will be Liev Schreiber, and the cousin of his, Christina Applegate. I don't know. Okay, so you got to have the sad stuff thrown in there to make it a comedy drama, right? Mm-hmm. So the James L. Brooks stuff. So Tara Reid's dad has cerebral palsy.
Yeah, but that plays funny.
No, not in this case. It'll be sad. He falls down the stairs. I can't even say it out loud. Her mother has rickets. Her dog has canine AIDS, we'll say. Her neighbor is not a gay neighbor, but he's afflicted with he's a really bad stutterer. Really bad stutterer. Just really embarrassing. And you know, there's a little road trip thing there. She comes back, you know. Blah, blah, blah. That's the plot. I basically just pitched the entire thing to you. It's already an automatic sell right there. But here's the title. Okay. It's the lawyer.
At the pool. In her backyard.
Lawyer. Backyard pool stuff. It's called Jacuzzi. There's a jacuzzi in her backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Poolside lawyer. J'accuse is the French for I accuse, which is a law thing. The title of the film is Jacuzzi.
We should always do these.
Rated R. Jacuzzi.
Even if we've got like all day open, we should just not do it at 11:30. This is good.
Jacuzzi, man.
Jacuzzi. Okay.
You don't even have to say yours. I already won.
Yeah, you always win.
No one wants to hear your crap now. Rickets? She's got rickets.
Ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding.
Okay, go ahead. Ready?
I'm a minivan.
I'm a dumb executive sitting behind a desk. I'm offering you bottles of water repeatedly. I've got a fake tan. I've got a cigar in my mouth. It's not lit. Pitch me your movie. Sell me.
Okay. Mine's just like one sentence.
Okay.
A guy gets a paparazzi buddy of his to help make him seem famous so he can get his showbiz career going.
And what's it called? That's your James L. Brooks thing?
Yeah, because it'll have like aspects of him, like it'll be all like an exploration of the nature of celebrity and the interaction between appearance and how things actually
what
are.
What messed up, sad people with illnesses does he go on a road trip with?
Well, there's no road trip involved, per se.
I even threw in a mention of a little road trip in mine, to make you think.
You just said there was a road trip. You didn't incorporate it into any sort of story.
No, I didn't.
They just
go on a road trip and it cuts to them driving.
It's like LA Story. They just go up to Santa Barbara for a weekend.
Yeah.
That could happen in mine too.
Sure.
He falls in love with the hot actress of the time, and
you got any actors in mind?
Becomes famous. No. As usual, I think I would actually pitch a nobody for the irony of using of him becoming famous in
That's smart. I like that.
And so basically, it would be almost like kind of a meta movie because it would be about the nature of celebrity, talking about celebrity.
The paparazzi is his friend.
Yeah, it's sort of his friend, and the whole thing is that he realizes, well, wait a minute, like, and he's like, maybe he's a struggling cartoonist, or maybe he's somehow involved. He wants to be involved in show business, and so he's like, well, and the paparazzi guy can never get any good shots, so he's like, well, why don't we just create this. This is all artificial, you know? You take pictures of me at this place and you can start the hub. I will mention this. What I'm thinking of in terms of it's a very minor reference. Oh, what's his goddamn name? Who's the guy that did Waiting for Guffman and...
Christopher Guest.
Christopher Guest.
Yeah.
Christopher Guest wrote and directed this movie called The Big Picture with Bacon.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is that he's trying to get his movie made, and he's bouncing between studios because he won something out of film school, and it's kind of offbeat and weird. And he's got this certain kind of story he wants to tell. It almost sounds a little derivative as a story, but then they keep wanting to change it, and they want to turn it from a regular love story into a lesbian love story because so on and so forth.
Right.
And in the end, he just ends up shooting a music video for his like neighbor's friend. And I was like that because they show him cutting like the raw 16mm stuff and stuff, which is a real pain in the ass to do.
Oh, totally. But
that's,
worth
that's
it in
true
the end,
craft, right?
Yeah.
So he shoots that, and then it gets famous because this is back when if you made a cool music video, they'd air it and people would see it and people would talk about you. So that plot element seems ridiculous now. But so everyone's talking about him now. He's got buzz, but the whole thing is he goes off to the desert with his girlfriend for the weekend, and all these studio executives are trying to get a hold of him, and it creates this whole artificial buzz around him. Everyone thinks they're trying to get him, so when he gets back, he's pretty much got pick of whatever studio he wants.
I like that.
It's this sense of if you create the artificial buzz, all of a sudden you become this celebrity that from doing nothing. It's kind of like, it's not even the Paris Hilton thing, because she has the money, and so she's you know, people know the name and stuff, and you're like, well, okay, she's related to, there's a nepotism there and something. It's like literally the guy comes from nothing, and it's like something happens.
Right.
Because there's people saying something about nothing. If you say something about nothing, people start thinking there's something there. You know, it's like if I ever see like an actress I don't think is attractive being talked up as being super hot, like on all the entertainment shows.
Then everyone else says they're hot.
Everyone else says they're hot, and I'm just like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah,
she kind of looks like the Hamburglar to me, you know?
Yeah, you know, slap a rack on the Hamburglar and
rabble.
Yeah, butterface.
So that's my pitch, and I don't have a good title for it. So
yeah,
just
last
say,
week
just say the,
we're even then, because last week I didn't have a if I thought for a long time I could come up with a title for the Isaac Newton thing, and it would have to be something to do with gravity and something to do with money, grave money. I don't know what.
Okay, I got a title.
So you go for a title.
It's sort of a pretentious title too. I like that. Celebrating Jim. The guy's name is Jim. And he becomes a celebrity.
That's good. I like that. It's no rejectors. Gosh, I wish we would have kept that podcast where I pitched the thing about where you're given a choice of having sex with Danny DeVito or Tom Cruise.
Why did you ask me that? That is awful.
Well, you know, it made for interesting non-recording conversation.
Yes, it did.
Gosh, we talked about. You know what's funny is that if we didn't think we were recording,
yeah. We
wouldn't have talked about any of that stuff. We wouldn't have talked for 35 minutes about if I'd rather have sex with Danny DeVito